House Committee on Revenue for May 6, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on HGR 21. Who's on that one? Kyle? Would you give us an introduction and we'll...
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJR 21 submits to the people for their approval or rejection a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution to be voted on at the next primary election. The proposed amendment would require a permanent limit on rate of ad valorem property taxes imposed by a county not less than $2 per thousand of assessed, or excuse me, county to not be less than $2 per thousand of assessed value. It requires county taxing districts to impose not less than the $2 per thousand of dollars in AV of operating taxes. It removes the application of constitutional limits contained in Article 11, Section 11B, which is the Measure 5 limits, from applying to the first $2 per thousand of the county operating taxes. And when I'm saying operating taxes, that's the permanent rate and local option taxes combined. That's what makes up the operating taxes. And if necessary, it requires compression of the county of county local option taxes first, followed by the permanent taxes that are above that $2 limit. And it would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016. And just as a really brief background, if you remember before, prior to Measure 50, the property taxes in Oregon was primarily based a levy-based system. After Measure 50, it became a rate-based system where the permanent rates of districts were established based upon what was being levied at the time by each taxing district. And it requires, Constitution requires change for those district permanent rates to be increased or changed, decreased for that matter, too.
Okay. Great. I have four people signed up. I thought there were going to be more today. And so there may be some people in the audience who would like to testify, and we'll get to you in a little bit. Let's start with Bill Hall, Martha Schrader, and Mike MacArthur, please.
Morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties. Thanks for holding this hearing on HGR 21. This is an adjustment to Oregon's property tax system, Measure 50, as we know it. The Association of Oregon Counties Legislative Committee, which includes over 40 commissioners, judges, and other elected officials, has endorsed this measure as a referral to the voters of Oregon to take a look at Measure 50 and make an adjustment that we think is necessary and needed in order to continue to provide basic county services in Oregon. If I can take you back a little bit, many of you are fairly new to this committee, and it was in 1996 that the voters chose to pass Measure 47, brought by a citizens initiative. That measure was then placed before the legislature in January of 97, and if sometime you have the opportunity visit with Dr. Warner about the history of how that came to be Measure 50 and then how Measure 50 was implemented and put into Oregon law and set up. It was really a rush by the legislature to get a measure passed here to be referred to the voters in May of 97 to be able to work on it again, and that continued that legislative session after it passed as Measure 50. So it was a snapshot in time. It was a snapshot that was going to put Measure 47 into effect, but as something workable, because 47 wasn't workable, we had to have 50. And so what that did is, the way that worked was, they froze the permanent rates that were given at that period of time. And that worked for some counties very nicely. I happen to live in one of those counties where it worked very nicely. Our permanent rate is $8.71 a thousand. And the reason for that was that we had a serial road levy that had been passed by the voters that was in operation at that time, about $3.50 a thousand, because we don't have timber in Sherman County, so we had to pay for roads with property taxes. So that got made permanent. That happened in at least one other county that I'm aware of. But many other counties were captured at a time when they were getting a reasonable amount of timber revenue, and so their rates were frozen at a very low rate, and that's our problem today. And so as a result of those permanently frozen low rates, we have public safety crisis in a number of counties. We have the state having to step up and help those counties. So that's why we think it's time to ask the voters if they would like to revisit Measure 50, and that's what this measure does. Take a look at that and see if there isn't, we shouldn't set a base for what property taxes ought to be for counties in the state of Oregon. So I have some commissioners with me here who'd like to speak to this. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Schrader. I serve as a Clackamas County Commissioner, and I'm here today with my colleagues of the Association of Oregon Counties and the Legislative Committee, of which I am a member, to talk to you about this bill today. As you've heard, low property tax rates are a product of Measure 47 and Measure 50 from the mid-90s. I actually remember being here at the time as a legislative assistant when we were working on that particular issue. In many cases, these rates were fixed without considering the many changes that come over time. Since 20 years have gone by since Measure 50, and in those 20 years, we have seen the loss of Oregon's great economic producer, and that is timber in our counties. Timber once paid for roads and sheriffs and schools, and I think we know that that is not the case anymore. Every month I read the news, I learn about one more mill being shut down or another 911 call that can't be answered quickly because counties with lower tax rates can't afford to pay for public safety. When I attend the ONC counties meeting, I hear from our timber counties about their struggle to afford basic public services. Oregon depends on its 36 counties to provide the basic public services, public safety most of all, and let's not even get started on roads, and particularly rural roads across our state. When the county fails, the responsibility reverts back to the state, and I know that you know this is a law established by the 2013 legislature, House Bill 3453, and that would put counties like our county in a position where we would try to help the position of our colleagues in other counties. I believe that House Joint Resolution 21 will help establish a floor for counties to provide basic services statewide. I know this is a hard decision for you to make, which is why HJR refers the proposed amendment to the voters. The cost of providing counting services has gone up. The cost of a sheriff's deputy has gone up. The cost of building roads has gone up. Please pass HJR 21 and refer this question to the people of Oregon. Thank you for letting me testify today on behalf of my colleagues and the counties. I feel very strongly that we are all in this together as 36 counties. And if some of our counties fail, we will all fail in our job and in our duty to the citizens of this state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hall. I live in Newport. I'm currently in my third term as a Lincoln County Commissioner. I'm also serving as the second vice president of the Oregon Association of Counties. I'm also here to ask you to support referral of HJR 21. My county is not one of the 13 counties that would be impacted if HJR 21 is approved. Many decades ago, in their wisdom, my predecessors proposed, and our citizens approved, a tax rate of $2.82 of assessed value for county services. Thanks to that foresight, we have been spared the worst of the trauma that many of our neighbors have experienced since harvesting of timber on national forests was so sharply curtailed. But we were still forced to make significant reductions in staff and services during the last recession, slashing our workforce by 15%. However, we have never had to consider all but eliminating sheriff's patrols or shutting down our jail. Yet that is the reality that has been staring too many Oregon counties in the face year after year. You could argue that HJR 21 is a Band-Aid, that we need to do a lot more to fix the economy of rural Oregon. I think you'd be correct, but HJR 21 is a crucial first step in ensuring that Oregon reclaims its own destiny. If HJR 21 is approved by the voters, we will no longer be at the mercy of the whims of Congress, going to Washington with hat in hand, asking for yet another bailout. We will have the crucial stability to ensure that every county in this great state can provide basic services. Cicero said, "The safety of the people shall be the highest law." 2,100 years later, Not much has changed. I find my constituents deliver only a few clear and consistent messages over time. First among them is an expectation that government keep them safe. For this reason, above all, I urge your support of HJR 21, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, sir.
Mr. Jeff, I can add a couple other comments.
Please.
We have letters submitted by other county commissioners in support of this referral, that from Commissioner Jamarillo of Benton County and Commissioner Fisher of Columbia County should be in your system.
And those are in all this.
And there, subsequent to AOC's discussion of this, there was some question about the effect of compression on other counties, and there's an amendment that deals with the compression on the other 23 counties, and Gil can talk to you in detail about the effects of that compression relief or compression imposition, if you like. Another issue that has been raised with us is that, well, how would this poll? Well, we have a poll out. We're finding that question right now. The poll will be available in a couple weeks.
Thank you. I will note that the amendment you refer to is not on OLIS.
Okay.
So we haven't seen it yet.
Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Representative Benz, and then Representative Johnson, please.
Mr. Chair, the idea is that the rest of the state would impose upon these counties that are under this $2 the obligation to pay wherever is between where they are and $2. Mm-hmm. And has this happened before? Have you guys researched this? Have the rest of the counties ever ganged up on these few and said, you shall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, in the property tax system, I think you could say that Measure 50 did that. In the income tax system, certainly we do that all the time.
Representative Bass? Yeah.
And the folks in these counties have made a decision, I'm guessing. Has every county that's in the group that's below the $2 tried to increase taxes, or have they just watched?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't believe every county has tried to do a local option levy. Some have done, and some have been successful. Lane has one right now that funds their jail that's in effect, but it still keeps them below $2.
Follow up? Yes, please. Yeah.
And is there evidence or history of bad things happening as a result of taxes not being high enough?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, certainly there's a litany of those things that we've been keeping track of over the years, and we can provide you a long list.
That would be wonderful. Please do.
Just one that comes to mind off the top of my head is, I think in the last year or two, the sheriff in Josephine County essentially advising women who had protective orders against them that unless they lived in the city of Grants Pass, he was encouraging them to move because he felt that they could no longer had the resources to guarantee those women their safety.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, another famous story is the tavern owner out by Cave Junction that asked the sheriff what to do if he had to call for help. The sheriff said, I can't guarantee anyone will be there anytime soon. He said, just don't shoot him in the back.
Oh, boy. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as a resident of one of those counties that's squarely in the middle of the yellow zone, I guess I have to push back a little bit on the assertion that all of the counties in that mix are like living in Appalachia. Hood River County's doing quite well. We also sustainably harvest about 80,000 acres of timber in our county that we manage, and we harvest on a sustainable basis that puts general fund revenue into the county that we can use for roads and maintenance and so forth. So we have a little bit of a special circumstance there, but I'm not aware of any clamoring to say we need to raise our property tax rates in Hood River County because we just can't make ends meet. Our county has been very proactive in co-opting and collaborating with our city government on shared services in a lot of cases as well. So I guess I'm just going to push back and say that all those counties in that yellow zone are wanting and needing to raise their base tax rate plus to $2. I guess as a follow-up then I would say as well, though, as we all learned last week with the PERS decision and so forth, the assertion that putting more revenue into anybody's coffers and that somehow it's going to equate into better outcomes or get to where we hope it gets to could be also fraught with difficulties because there are a lot of cost drivers out there that our local counties have no control over either. So anyway, I just would want to get that on the record. I appreciate what you're trying to do, but push back a bit on the assertion that all counties under $2 per thousand are somehow really lacking in services because they're not.
Representative Whitson.
I was wondering, in the yellow counties up there, How many of those counties support, since the AOC is in support, how many of those counties are in support of this resolution?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I would have to go back and look at who was present on the day we voted on that, but almost all counties in Oregon are represented on our legislative committee. At least they have the opportunity to be. I know that Klamath is. I'm not sure of who was there and who voted that day. I can get that to you, Representative Whitsitt.
Yes, I would like to see, for this committee, to see what the commissions voted on this, since you're representing them, what each commission voted on all 36 counties for this, and specifically those counties. And I have a follow-up question.
Please, yeah.
I was wondering if you have any idea how many voters in Oregon actually own property in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I don't, but we can research that and
That'd
see
what
we can find out.
Thank you.
That's a fascinating question. I think it'd be an interesting interesting thing to get an answer to. Let me, Representative Vance, go ahead, and then I'll make my point.
Thank you. Sorry. So there was a deal, if you will, made by a former governor and folks that would kick in the event all these services closed down. Perhaps you can share with us this alternative as compared to what that deal is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that deal was memorialized in House Bill 3453. And essentially what that bill prescribes is in a situation where there's a public safety crisis, that is, public safety isn't adequate, resolution can be brought by a county commission or through the governor's office, through the administration, to call for the creation of a fiscal distress board that looks at the county, looks at the situation. If that board finds, in fact, there is distress to the level that puts the public in public safety in danger, then revenue measures can be created that create revenue from that county, half of the costs of bringing the public safety up to adequate level comes from the county, half comes from the state legislature through the emergency board. So the public safety crisis is temporarily alleviated by these two revenue sources that are created by the financial distress board through the state mechanism that we've described.
Thank you.
Has that ever been used?
Mr. Chair, no.
It hasn't. I didn't think so.
Mr. Chair, if I may, though, it has been contemplated seriously.
Oh, I'm sure. I suspect it has. This committee, of course, is aware of the issue that involves the funding of the offices of the tax collector and assessor's responsibility around the state, and how some of the counties have been in situations where their capacity even to fund that office has been in jeopardy. We've got mechanisms in place to do that, and I am quite sure that if a county was in a position where none of those mechanisms worked, we'd be on the hook to spend general funds to make that that function happen, so that schools, cities, and others would receive the property taxes that otherwise wouldn't be assessed or collected. I think also that the state police have increased patrols in some parts of rural counties without getting any compensation from the county as a result
Correct.
Of the fact that the sheriff is simply not available to do that work. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that is accurate. In Josephine County, I believe like 11 extra state police are now being assigned there that wouldn't have been there on a normal distribution.
I'm getting back to Representative Bent's first question about the rest of the state and its involvement in these low-funded counties. And we are looking forward to that list of horribles you're going to send us on that topic.
Sure.
But those are the two that came to mind immediately to me.
Mr. Chair, in addition, there's a letter, I believe in OLIS, from the Curry County assessor, who I believe states that they're as much as 20 years out of currents being current on their checking values and are finding that they're missing whole new houses that are constructed because they don't have the capacity to go out and look for values. And so that means that there's less money coming into the state school fund. Of course, there's the mechanism of CAFA to penalize counties that don't keep up on their assessment and taxation process. So they're scrambling in Curry to keep up with that.
So this might be an example where we ought to talk to Representative Buckley about funding the assessor's office to go out and find those missing houses, because the school tax that we receive might be more than what we'd spend out of general fund to fund the assessor to do the work.
Mr. Chair, you probably recall that
that's an interesting thought, isn't it?
The state legislature used to fund the CAFA, used to add $5 million to the CAFA fund to help improve the efficiency of the assessment taxation process to capture some of that value.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And if I could add a couple of to Mr. MacArthur's point, like I know in our county, for instance, under the CAFA program, at one point it was supporting 44% of the operational budget for our program. In the next fiscal year, it's projected to be 17%. And to a couple of points that Representative Johnson made, former president of our association, Commissioner Ben Boswell, once said, if you see one county, you've seen one county. And we certainly didn't mean to convey that every one of those counties in yellow up there are facing such extreme dire straits. But the reality is many of them are, despite, I think, very, I would say, heroic efforts to make public safety a priority. You know, in our own county, since I am something of an amateur historian, I went back when I started hearing people complaining about, why can't you do more for public safety? 1989, 25 years ago in Lincoln County, 25% of our general fund went for public safety. It's now currently up to 50%. A lot of things drove that, probably chief being going from a 24-bed jail to a 161-bed jail. And these services are expensive in training, equipment, and personnel, but I think it's, of all our jobs, it's our single most important job.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Mr. Groner, please. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? This is all I have signed up. Well, boy. Okay. Ralph?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, and I represent AFSCME. Those who don't know what that stands for, it's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I just noticed that 8 of the counties who were in the yellow were our counties. When I say our, we represent them, but then we represent 90% of the counties in the state. We are the local government, in essence, union in Oregon, because we also represent most of the cities, most of the counties, and local government. I am proud to be here today as a former county commissioner, because two really bright county commissioners, one, Representative Leininger, serves on your committee, and Commissioner Schrader also serves, and I served way back when we created the public safety measure for our sheriff in Clackamas County. I look at this a little different than locally now. Where I've changed a bit is, hold it. I've been my brother's keeper. I love to support lots of nonprofits, as all you do. But I'll be honest with you. When I look at the things such as assessment being behind in these counties, meaning you just hit a key point, Mr. Chair, that means me, the state taxpayer, is picking up more than my fair share of those counties who aren't bringing the property on the rolls in a timely fashion. Law enforcement, I hate that, because my union provides the money for the elections right now in Polk County, Josephine County, repeatedly. When I say my union, my members provide the money and the door-to-door efforts in those counties for public. So Polk County we're in right now, helping. Senator Boquist, by the way, is helping with that in a big way. Social services, the rest of us pay elections. If you're not properly and you can't account for your elections, guess what? It's hydraulics, as Mike likes to say. The fact is, if they don't cover what's required by you, the fact is all of us chip in. Now, it's all of those chip-ins to my brother that's finally got me to testify here. I love you all. I love those counties. They're my members. But the fact of the matter is, the people who live in Clackamas County have already supported their libraries 100%. We've supported extension. When they went under, we supported it. Our sheriff's levy, thank you, every 5 years gets unanimous support. Whereas I look in other counties and I say, what's it costing me finally? What's it costing the taxpayer? Because we got to pick up that loss down in Curry. I'm sorry, Curry County. I love you. Beautiful county. Gold Beach. I love it. But the fact is, if taxpayers ever had a study done, and I wish we did, to show because of those counties really behind in assessment, really behind in their elections department, really behind in these various components, who's picking up to keep by standards of law that have set that money? Guess who? Portland, Clackamas, Washington, pardon me, Lane County, the other counties. We all love you. We visit you. But the fact is, the brotherhood of man can only go so far. We're getting hit with taxes higher and higher where we live now. So my whole point is, love it. I think 21 should be referred to the people. I think all the people should have the right to vote on it, and they all should be educated as to what it means. And I'm probably going to alienate some, but we do rep those counties, and we represent your counties where you live, and we chip in more than our share. When it comes to your levies are needed, you ask, we're there. So we'd appreciate it if Measure 21 went to a vote of the people. I don't believe it's a local issue only. It, in fact, is a statewide issue of concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Gruner? I think some of what you've spoken to will be coming back to us from the list. And that will be a helpful device. I will note that this resolution actually has a subsequent referral to rules, but that's where it will go if it passes this committee, because Rules Committee needs to keep track of the motions we sent out, the measures we sent out for a vote of the people. And of course, it being a constitutional amendment, it requires a vote of the people. It's not something that the legislature can do on its own. On its own motion. Anything else for Mr. Groner? Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on HJR 21. Colleagues, we're going to look at both of these other measures together. So we'll open the public hearings on HJR 20 and HJR 12. Are you on those two?
Yes.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Would you like me to describe both?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay. So HJR 20 would submit to the people for their approval or rejection a proposed revision to the Oregon Constitution to be voted on at the next primary election. The revision would allow local option ad valorem property tax to be imposed outside of certain constitutional limits. Those are the Measure 5 limits. It would require taxing districts to submit the local option levy to the voters at an election in November of an even-numbered year and obtain a majority approval of the voters voting. It limits local option levies to no more than 10 years. Right now, the limit would be primarily it's going to be 5 years. It can be 10 years for capital or local options used to support capital projects. It would allow taxing districts to submit to the voters for approval at an election in a November of even-numbered year in 2 years leading up to the expiration of a local option levy, an extension of that local option levy. It does require a statement presented to the voters when voting on the local option levy. That would include the length of time in which the levy will be imposed and also a statement explaining to the voters that the levy will not be subject to the constitutional Measure 5 taxing limits. It requires legislative assembly to enact a homestead property tax relief program available to persons meeting certain eligibility requirements based on age or disability. Those requirements are not spelled out in the SJR, just that they would be based on age or disability. And the relief program would require that assessed value of a homestead for those qualifying homesteads to not increase while the eligible person is enrolled in the program. And
excuse me. Go ahead.
Moving on to HJR 12, submitting to the people for their approval or rejection an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to be voted at the next primary election. And in this case, the proposed amendment would require on the first assessment date following a date of sale or other transfer that the assessed value of the property subject to the sale or transfer be equal to the real market value of the property. It also would require that in that initial year, the maximum assessed value is equal to the real market value. So when a property sells or is transferred, the maximum assessed and assessed by the property would equal the RMV at time at that the following assessment year. Following the reset at sale, if you will, the maximum assessed value would then increase under current law, so the 3% provision would continue going forward after the sale or transfer. And it requires the Legislative Assembly to enact all laws necessary to implement the proposed amendment changes, and this would apply to property tax or assessment years beginning on or after January 1st, 2019.
Very good. We have a number of people who want to testify on this, on these two measures. So let's start with Wendy Johnson, Pete Truney, and John McArdle, please. I'm sorry, it's Truax. One of them is easy to read, and the other one's very difficult. So I mispronounced it. I apologize.
No problem.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for scheduling these two property tax bills today. We have a panel from the League of Oregon Cities today. Two of them are sitting board members and one a past board member and then a finance director to kind of go over the big picture and get into some of the details. Property tax has been a priority for the League for a long time, and you'll be hearing about two suggested solutions, but we really request today that you look at the bigger picture and recommend that you form a work group to address all of the problems together, because like Measure 50 had so many changes, we really need comprehensive reform to address all the problems rather than tweaks. But we do recommend the two bills before you, and we'll use those as examples. Today,
let's be clear. Are you recommending that these go out for the next election, or are you recommending that we set up a work group?
Chair Barnhart, we're really recommending comprehensive reform. We don't know that there is the votes right now to send these two measures, but we'd like you to hear them. If there are the votes to get them out, sure, it would be great. But they're both tough issues because there are winners and losers with both of them. They fix an issue, but they don't fix all of the problems, and so they're just tough measures to get through.
Great. I think that's a maybe.
Maybe. There you go.
All right.
Equivocal.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
So to my left, we have the president of the League of Oregon Cities, Mayor Truex. He's the mayor of Forest Grove, our present president, and he's been the mayor of Forest Grove since 2009. And then to his left is City Councilor Brad Nanke, who's our League's vice president, and he's been on the Salem City Council since 2000. And I'll turn it over to them to go into more details.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Pete Truax. I'm, as Wendy has said, the mayor of the city of Forest Grove, president of the League of Oregon Cities, and Aaron's grandfather. I want to thank the committee for the time to testify today, because this is a huge issue for the 242 cities in the state of Oregon committed to assisting with the passage of legislation that enhances local decision-making, providing sustainable sources of revenue, and streamlining governmental processes. Property tax reform is, as you have heard in the past and will be for the foreseeable future, a League priority. Where the money goes in property taxes in Oregon, you see the figures up on the screen. Cities get 22% of it, school districts 42%, counties, our neighbors and our compatriots in local government get 18%, community colleges and special districts the remaining 18%. Cities, again, as I said, receive approximately 22% of property tax revenues in the state of Oregon. Property taxes on average represent approximately 60% of a city's revenues. It varies from city to city. You can see in some cases it's as low as 55%. Franchise fees are the second largest. That's a story for another day, another committee. 10% comes from other sources and charges and services for other fees, 11%. And then the state funds, liquor, gas, and other taxes, 10%, but it's that huge, huge blue chunk on the right of the pie graph that we're concerned with, and that property tax figure of 55% is huge for the cities in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. I don't mean
I'm
to
sorry.
Be too nitpicky, but I just want to make sure that we're so. Thank you.
So this is an example, but this is not an average city? Because it says that property taxes on average represent about 60%, but this example just has 55. So this is just some city, or is this generally an average city but with a little bit higher of a percentage?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Warner, there's really it's hard to come up with an average for each of these, so this just made the numbers round up it better, but the average is 60% for property tax.
Okay.
But this is—I think this is actually maybe Eugene or Springfield. Fairly. It's a particular city, but it just shows.
But everything else is fairly representative.
Correct.
Thank you.
On the next chart, the city expenditure is the example. The one I want to really take a look at is the public safety, and that's 55% of virtually every city's responsibility. That's police, that's fire and medical rescue. In Forest Grove, I do want to tell you that our general fund, our general operating fund, the monies generated by property taxes will not cover our police and our fire. We have to have a local option levy, and we've renewed it for the last dozen years. But we need to do that every 4 to 5 years in order to keep the pace, and that local option levy helps us bridge the gap and helps us also fund those other, which I feel are also necessary services of the of cities, libraries and parks and recreation. Those things I think go hand in hand with public safety. In our neighbors in Washington County, Cornelius's police department has been taken over. Not taken over in a hostile sense, but has been Washington County's now running the police department in Cornelius. Their fire department is now under the leadership of Forest Grove's fire chief, who is having the dual responsibility of working out scheduling and training for Cornelius's as well as Forest Grove's fire department. And our neighbor to the north, Banks, relies on not only Washington County, but also the Oregon State Police for its law enforcement issues. So those property tax revenues generally used are for public safety, again, as I said, for police and fire. They have a significant impact on city services, again, public safety at the top. Budget balancing survey results, most cities since 2007 and 2008 have reduced infrastructure spending and maintenance. They've decreased their service levels. They've reduced personnel, including public safety. And again, I will Forest Grove-ize this by indicating that we are 2 to 3 police officers shy if we use that one officer per 1,000 measuring stick for City of Forest Grove. We have had growth in our population not matched by growth in our police department. We have one full-time 3-member crew on at our fire department on 24-hour shifts, and that means if that crew has to leave, we usually have to rely on mutual aid to fund the second call, to man the second call, person the second call, excuse me, and then be able to get our volunteers to the station to provide backup. And that's becoming increasingly difficult. On infrastructure, we ran surveys of cities on cities deferring maintenance. This table indicates that the figure has risen from 38% to 43% on cities deferring maintenance on water, sewer, and stormwater infrastructure. And the figure for roads, bridges, sidewalks, and transportation infrastructure and deferring has gone from 56% to 59% in a year. Purchasing fleets, making do with older cars, and in the police department, that's sometimes a critical issue. That figure has also risen. I guess to say that the figures are pretty much bleak. They're showing an increase with the one spot where we don't want an increase. The answer to the question, no, my city has not deferred maintenance in the last 3 years. That has gone from 36% saying no, they haven't done it, to 26%. So 1 out of 4 cities in the state of Oregon is deferring maintenance that reported on this graph. I don't want to say every city reported back. That would be wonderful, but Measure 5, again passed in 1990, limits property taxes 10 per thousand of real market value, again for general governments. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. You know all of this. $5 per thousand of real market value for schools, no limit on property taxes for bonds. Now, if the property taxes on an individual property would exceed the Measure 5 limits, we have compression kicking in. They're reduced on the property until those limitations are met. Voter-approved temporary taxes are reduced, first of all, to zero before collections from permanent rates are compressed. Now, if we were in compression in Forest Grove, it wouldn't matter whether we passed that local option levy or not. We wouldn't be able to collect it. That's not local control. That's not local option. That's not an opportunity for a city to use its charter and its constitutional right in the state of Oregon to have local options. Half of the cities in the state of Oregon are involved in compression. I believe all of our counties are, and 90% of our school districts. Again, we are a fortunate city in Forest Grove that we have not been impacted by compression, but we can see it lurking over the horizon. Losses due to compression. The graph shows it's almost $212 million in public funds, funds that could be used to build bridges, build roads, improve schools, help the counties with their public safety issues. That's a pretty chunk of change. As Everett Dirksen used to say, a million here, a million there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. $212 million is real money.
Now, just to be certain, these are taxes foregone.
Yes.
Not property values.
No.
Taxes foregone. Thank you.
That's what?
$212 million.
For the 2013-14.
Yes.
So data's a little old. It's getting a little better.
That's fine. Just so I know what the numbers mean. Please go ahead. I apologize for interrupting. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. House Joint Resolution 20 is the constitutional amendment to allow local voter choice to adopt that operating levy outside Measure 5 limits or outside compression. HJR 20, if passed, would not raise anyone's taxes, but would empower voters to authorize a tax increase and then empower the local entity, the local government, to collect those fees that the voters deem necessary for operation of that particular local entity. Again, limited to 5 years, and again, to vote at the general election. I've given you a number of examples in Forest Grove about how we are struck by it. We know that there are a number of cities around the state. I have toured the state with League of Oregon Cities personnel and talked to those cities. A number of them, Coquille and Curry County, jumps to the front. They are considerably have a considerable level of angst because very often in conjunction with their compression problems are Curry County's compression problems, and they tell the apocryphal story of arresting somebody, and before they can finish with the paperwork, that person has been released from the county jail. And that's, I don't think, a way they want to run the railroad, even in Curry County or in Coquille. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Can we go ahead and get the last one, and then we'll go to questions, please?
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm not Brad Nanke. He's better looking than I am. The counselor from Salem will be speaking behind me. I'm John McArdle. I'm the mayor of Independence. I'm the former president of the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm also past president of the Oregon Mayors Association. And I'm here today on my vacation time from a local community college. So this is how I spend my vacation time, and all the other elected officials up here today are all the mayors are and counselors are volunteers also. There's nothing that mayors get more fired up about than talking about providing services to our local community. The issues that you are hearing us talk about today are paramount. They cross urban, rural, they cross red, blue, because in the municipal world, we don't have those. We just about getting services to folks. And so I'm here to speak specifically about HJR 12. And I get to talk a little bit about, you know, Measure 5, the fix for Measure 47. I'll build on a little bit that you've heard earlier. you know, Measure 5 property taxes until Measure 50, property taxes were assessed on real market value. But then after Measure 50, we now have assessed value. Today, there are significant disparities between similar properties with nearly identical real market value due to the use of assessed value. The problems are structural in nature. Let me outline a couple of them. There's a base problem. When Measure 50 came in 95-96, they were taking it a snapshot in time. Property taxes are assessed over a six-year period. You don't upgrade everything in the same year. You do some one year, some the next year, and it's a six-year cycle. So when that cycle, some were at the high level, some were at the low level. There's a disparity that's never been adjusted for. New and significant improved property doesn't use the 1995-96 real market value base. Instead, they use a county average ratio to try to approximate the real market value. Different parts of the county that I live in, you know, Fall City versus West Salem, really different worlds, okay? In addition, the base in 95-96, it locked in an arbitrary number that doesn't recognize how neighborhoods have changed in more than 20 years. There's just an arbitrariness. You know, trying to sit down and explain, and I know those, you've all gone door to door as I have, you've all been to town hall meetings, trying to explain the property tax system in Oregon at a town hall meeting, let alone somebody at a door, it's complicated. You folks have an understanding, and even it's complicated. The only guy that probably really gets it is the guy from Tualatin who will be talking, who's the finance director. But you see up on the wall some of the details of Measure 50 that I outlined. I'm going to continue moving forward. I want to point out that, and I think this group knows it, but many don't, that city revenues are not like state revenues. You guys get a bump when the economy goes up. We don't get the same bump because the numbers are not tied, and there's a disparity. We're not connected to that. Property values don't move. It limits our ability to move forward. You have in front of you on the screen the property tax, the permanent rates. Again, when these were established, they locked it in where they were. You don't get a chance to change it. Even if your voters want to change your basic rate, we're not allowed to do that. And so you see all over the place. My city, as a matter of fact, is at $4.59. We're right in the middle. And then you can see many of you folks on the committee, you see your particular numbers. And there is, I know that they missed Lake Oswego, but your number is $4.97, except outside the school districts where it's $4.59. I didn't want you to think that we ignored you. We
thank goodness.
Thank you. Heaven help us. So it's all over the board. Some places on the coast have zero, okay? And okay. Yes, you're familiar with that. Let me keep moving. Let's use a real live example. These are two real live properties that talk about the differences. Two properties that are effectively the 323,000 versus 320,000. They were bought in the same month. You know, you can see the locations. You know, in my community, there have been homes that were trashers that were fixed up and then sold for a hefty price, but they're still taxed at the trasher level. There's a disparity that's not right. That's a disparity that does not allow us to continue to provide the services that our folks want. And it's just not fair. Enough said. Here's what we propose. Joint Resolution 12, an amendment. Okay, and I think the most important part here is that this is a bill that's not about raising any person's current taxes. It's upon the sale of the property. Grandma's going to get to continue to live in the same house, paying the same on the same assessed value as last year and the next year, as long as grandma's there. But when it's sold, then it gets reset. And that reset's really important because that helps us provide the services that Mayor Truax and others have talked about. That's public safety. That's the things that make our cities the kind of places that are special. So we need this kind of consideration to move forward because we're slowly strangling. You've heard that from, and when you talk to your folks in your respective areas, we're jammed up. It's only going to get worse, and we really need you to take a look at this. I'll look forward to any questions you care to shoot at me, or otherwise I'll turn it over to the better-looking Brad Nanke, who sits behind me.
And before you get away,
yes, sir.
We want to ask if there are any questions for this panel. Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering if you could discuss where PERS fits in your pie chart up there. You had a pie chart back at the beginning. And I was wondering, say, regarding public safety, does PERS for retired public safety officers come out of the 55% public safety budget in an average year?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I'm really the wrong person to ask. Forest Grove is not a PERS city. We are equal to or better than. But my understanding is that that's part of what a city budgets for as far as costs for employees going along with wages and other benefits that PERS is folded into that. And the recent ruling is going to impact that and impact that in a major way. And for police, I believe it's even greater in the amount of money that has to be set aside and the amount of money that is given to those public employees.
If I may follow up.
Please.
I was wondering, when you did your studies there, if you determined what percentage of the individuals within the public safety, say 55% that you have there, are fully retired and collecting Tier 1 PERS, which would be the equivalent of a person actually working for a full salary, and what percentage are actually working in the cities? Do you understand what I'm asking? I'm trying to figure out, are we paying for a lot of people that are no longer working for us but have retired? I mean, they've earned their benefits, but that's all part of this, is my understanding. And I had a further question, you know, if you can look this up. In the public safety, how many or what percentage would go to public safety officers on the road or on a beat versus those in administrative or upper management positions that do not contribute directly to the public safety of the public outside of sitting in an, you know, being in an office, sitting isn't the right word, being in an office in an administrative position?
Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I can't answer for other cities. Forest Grove, we have virtually 100% of our officers are on the street at some time or another. Even our chief is out there. We have roughly 22 officers, uniformed patrolmen, patrol officers in Forest Grove, and that figure, of that figure, I would say all 22 at one time or another are clerking, are doing record work in the office and out on the beat. There is, I believe, one office assistant in Forest Grove.
Okay, I was looking for the actual people out on the street doing the beat work. Or the deputy work, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to establish what percentage of that pie, what that looks like. How much right. is PERS? How much are people working? How much is administrative?
I think we can ask for a summary of that kind of information. It's only marginally germane to these two resolutions. I understand the point you're trying to get at has to do with the city expenses,
right.
that kind
right.
of thing.
That's
but,
what I'm asking.
But I think it's... It's only marginally related to what we're working on here, and perhaps we can ask for the association to put together some numbers for us that might be helpful for Representative Whitsitt on these topics.
Thank you.
Be happy to do that. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I think it's the PERS rate is really what's going to change.
Well, and of course the issue, I think, if I can paraphrase, is the difference between what you're paying in order to deal with current ongoing employees who are receiving this as a benefit and what you end up paying as a result of both of the underfunded past liabilities and as a piece of that the amounts that result from the Supreme Court decision the other day. I think that's what you're after if I understand that right.
Sure.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, if I could, I'm just a mayor, so I know nothing, but I could throw a couple of people under the bus. The finance director for the city of Tualatin is here and may have some of that information later on.
He'll be up next.
Yeah.
Yes. Any other questions for this panel? Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the underlying theme of these is to either tweak the system within the limit of the Constitution without upsetting that limitation piece, or to allow folks to exceed the limitation. And that would suggest, and I'm not sure if the second one probably fits in that initial category where you're simply trying to tweak and remain under the limitation. Because both of these would have to go out as constitutional amendments, they would require convincing the people that the limitation should be set aside. And I would suggest that the Supreme Court's decision last week make that extremely difficult, because most people are going to say, if you're going to feed the monster with our tax dollars and make it bigger, we want nothing to do with it because we can't control it. So I would ask you, because I know you've given this lots of thought, how it is that we are to convince the people of Oregon that any of these changes would not result in simply a more out-of-control circumstance such as we saw the consequences of last week.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I think we've seen that voters are willing to pass local option levies. I think the last numbers were 17 out of 20. So voters are still willing to increase their taxes. It's not an easy climb each time, of course. But the problem is right now, even when they do, it's not fair on the system that we have, and some are voting for a tax increase that they never actually get because of the problems with 5 and 50. So I hear what you're saying, but I think right now we don't even have the option.
And I think, well, go ahead, Representative Vance, please.
What I'm getting at here is that each of these conversations is, I welcome them. It's just that there is a barrier between us and constitutional change that has to, I just went to the heart of it. And so when people come up and talk about how they would like us to support these kinds of changes, they need to also address the bigger issue lurking in the background, which is the need, we all think, for this arbitrary limit, because we fear we can't control that which we might otherwise create. So someone's going to have to address that issue squarely. So please do, as you come up to testify, because I'd like to hear the answer.
All right. Thank you. And of course, the habit of the legislature has been, not lately at least, has been not to send out measures for a vote unless we already know whether or not the people are inclined to consider a campaign and potentially vote for it. There are a number of measures that were sent out in the early part of this millennium that failed badly because nobody bothered to do that. And I think it's safe to say that until the polling data comes back on these kinds of measures, you won't expect them to move. And even then, of course, it still requires that people go out and explain the issues to the voters and get people to say, yeah, that makes sense to me, or not.
Yeah.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, you know, you're absolutely right. There would have to be a sales campaign. But as was pointed out, people need to be able to have the opportunity to control their own area, to let them make a choice, because...
See, that's part of the sales campaign, and using your words.
Well, let's take it away from sales and talk about good government.
Yes.
Because that's what this is.
I would prefer that, too.
Is that let people have the opportunity to decide for themselves, because we're about local control. We're about, you know, we get ambushed all the... Going to the grocery store, going for a container of milk can take 45 minutes. Okay, you guys know that. It doesn't take you 45. Okay, maybe. You know,
he doesn't go.
Small town.
Oh, yeah.
In a small town, it does. You know, everybody knows you, okay, whether you're in flip-flops and shorts or not. But let people have the opportunity. Let's not put systemic blockages here. Let's let people have the opportunity to decide what they want. If they want that much. If they want services, let them say they'd like them. And the other thing is there has been some studies that have shown people want to make sure that it's fair. The example that I gave of the two houses, okay, that's blatantly unfair. If, you know, if we live in the same house and he's paying a dollar and I'm paying 10, I'm not going to be really happy with that. And that's something government should be about, fairness. So it's fairness, and let us have our let our local people decide what's best for them. Sorry, I didn't mean to make that.
Yeah, I think that's.
I'm on the stump again.
I understand the campaign.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much. We appreciate it. Let's hear from Brad Nanke and Don Hudson, please. Okay.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll see if I get the introductions right this time. So I already introduced Councillor Nienke, the last panel when it was Mayor McArdle, but to my left this time is Councillor Brad Nienke from Salem, and then to his left is Don Hudson, the finance director from Tualatin.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Brad Nanke. I'm finally here. I've been a Salem City Councilor for, I'm in my 15th year now, and I'm currently here today as Vice President of the League of Oregon Cities. And I wanted to kind of share details about Salem and how this all plays out inside of our local city here. We're actually in the middle of our budgeting process right now. Our property tax estimated revenues are $60 million, and that's 56% of operating revenues. It is our largest source of revenue, which was depicted in the pie chart you saw earlier. At $60 million, that does not cover our police and fire. They're estimated at $65.7 million for public safety in the coming budget year. In regards to how 5 and 50 have hamstrung Salem's budget, we eliminated in the fiscal 2013 year 45 positions. Of those, 11 were police department positions, 5 of those being sworn officers. We closed 2 of our 11 fire stations. 4 positions in the library were eliminated, and we cut the West Salem branch hours by 50%. Ending in that fiscal year 2012-13 and the 4 years period before that as well, we eliminated 89 general fund positions. We look at the revenue sources. We have essentially a flat line on anything but the property taxes. And you look at our expenses, and the majority is personnel. And we're locked in on the public safety side from binding arbitration. So whatever is kind of the going in the comparable cities, so our costs go up every year, and our income does not increase at that same cost. And so we're in a structural deficiency on how to fund city operations. We have seen some recovery in compression. We were, I think, at like 2/3 at about $1 million a year that we were losing in compression. We've seen a real market values increase about 11% in the area. And then mixing that with the PERS temporary relief, we were able to hold the line budget for last year and the previous. Looking as we estimated whether or not the PERS issue would resolve itself or not, we're still looking at another $6 million cut over the next 5 years, and that will be realized now with the PERS rates as they are. As the graph said, Salem's permanent tax rate is $5.83 per thousand, and we've historically levied at that full rate. As a point of comparison, illustrating the arbitrary nature of freezing that tax back in 1997, the city of Eugene, essentially, we trade places every now and again for second and third largest cities in the state. Eugene's rate is $7 versus Salem's at $5.83. Add into that that we're the capital city and the county seat for Marion County, and we have 32% of our properties that are not on the tax rolls. It makes it very difficult for us.
I assume you're referring to this building, among others.
Right. And City Hall and, you know, Marion County Courthouse. And that's essentially a given based on the fact that we're the seats on both of those and, you know, our city operations as well. We could attempt a levy, but again, as Mayor Truax had said, we would go immediately into compression. Marion County already levies over the $10 per thousand. We would be crunched out first, and if anything, we would just put more properties into compression at that time. So what I'm asking for in and above the two bills resolutions on the floor today is to really look at comprehensive change. We need property tax reform. We can't tweak and fix here and there. It has to be a full package. Cities, as we go out with smaller pieces, how many times do you tweak before you get to that place where all of those issues are resolved across the different types of jurisdictions? We know the voters want assurances that there's not volatility in that system. And they need to know that any increases will be appropriate. If we balance, you know, we have a structural issue with city government employees. They're pretty much locked on their compensation. We have property owners, myself included. I voted for these because I was taking 13% a year that they were increasing my property taxes. We need to find that balance in between those two to where cities can provide those things that our citizens want. And people aren't, especially those on fixed incomes, which is their real bugaboo on this, who don't really have that increase in income potential over the rest of their days. How do we balance those two to where we can all coexist together? Government, I know we are always high on the opinion polls. I think a little more so at the city level because they get to talk to us at the grocery store. But we need to look at a couple of other things as well. The statutory property tax exemptions in ORS Chapter 307, the way they're set, minimize some of that flexibility that local governments have. We are committed and will be continued to be committed to looking at property tax and its reforms, and we would encourage the legislature and the committee to help us in that by forming an interim work group and bring something forth in the next long session.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Appreciate you having us here today. I'm Don Hudson. I'm the finance director with the City of Tualatin and the vice chair of this league's Finance and Taxation Committee. As has been mentioned by Mayor Truax, Mayor McCardle, and Councilor Nanke, our property tax system in Oregon is complex, it's arbitrary, and it's full of inequities. I'm going to go into a little bit of some additional things. I don't want to repeat a lot of what's been said up here. I know your time is limited. I want to say, though, that even those of us that are in the business, this is a very complex system. I was a finance director in Oregon for about 7 years before I fully started to understand, and there's still a lot of pieces of the system that are hard to understand. In the document you have in front of us, and then Wendy has up on the screen up here, the league's identified 8 problems with the system that need to be reformed. We've talked about the two resolutions in front of you, but I want to talk a little bit about a few of those and go into a little bit more in depth, and I'll be happy to answer any questions when we're done. The permanent rate, we talked about it, that it was set back when Measure 50 was passed. It was actually set by a very complex formula, but basically it was what was in effect at the time it was passed. So that's why you see the disparities. It didn't take into consideration what the needs of an entity were before Measure 50 was passed or immediately thereafter. And things have changed a lot in the 20 plus years since it's been passed. If you look at that chart that was up there before, Tualatin at their 227 rate is the lowest of all the entities that were listed there. We are one of the lowest in the whole Portland metro area. And we constantly struggle to stay lean and provide those services that our citizens continue to ask for. There are many things that we could be providing, but it's difficult for us to do it at such a low tax rate. For the assessed value, again, it was set at an arbitrary date in 95, 96, and then it was reduced to real market value by 10%. So we already started with a gap between assessed value and real market value. And as the properties boomed, that gap got larger. The 3% growth limit is another issue that is problematic in the system. The cost of providing base services in many years costs us larger than 3%, but yet we are limited, at least on the residential, at that 3% value. What a lot of people think is that we are guaranteed a 3% increase in our assessed value, and I'm here to tell you that's not true. Beginning in fiscal year 10-11, we saw for three consecutive fiscal years, our assessed value growth less than 3%, and in two of those 3 years, we are less than 2%. My costs weren't going up at that low of an amount, and so there again, we had to make some tough decisions. Compression, I'm going to spend a few minutes trying to talk about compression, because I got to say that is one of the most complex and difficult concepts to understand and to explain to people.
I will let you know that the committee's heard this topic discussed in detail earlier this year, and we do it basically during every long session. There are several new members on the committee who probably could use a refresher even now, but for some of us, this is old news at this point.
Okay, I'll just go into a brief, and feel free to stop me if something that is heard.
Yeah.
First, there's a calculation done by the assessor's office on every single property in the district. It's the Measure 5 limits, because those are based on real market value, and then the levy rate is on assessed value. So they have to take those two calculations, compare them on every property, and then determine if there's compression. Local option levies, as you know, are compressed first, which makes planning for a local option levy very difficult. You have to take into consideration compression loss when you're setting what your rate is. So you're likely going to levy a higher rate than's needed. If you were to get 100%, you would be able to levy a lesser rate than you have to, because you have to factor in compression losses. There's some examples of compression losses that I'd like to talk about quickly. The first likely is the city of Sweet Home. They have passed local option levies since 1986, and in 2010 they approved levies again at 60 and 55% of the vote, yet statewide tax limits cut 35% of what the voters approved. The city of Albany public safety levy only collects about 2/3 of the revenue that they collect, or they levy. In the school district side, West Lynn Wilsonville School District, they only collect about 29% of their local option levy because of statewide limits. The Portland Children's levy was reduced by 51%. I was able to, in the last day, collect some 14-15 compression data for the three counties in the metro area, Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County. The total compression losses across the local government as well as education for total of those three counties was over $130.6 million. School district levies lost $41 million. General government levies lost $50.9 million. 42.2% of that loss was local option levies. That's a lot of money that people voted for that are not being collected. You may know about the Multnomah County Library District. They became a library district because they were functioning off local option levies, and because the compression was so high, they were making promises to keep their libraries open 7 days a week. And because of losses in the compression, they cut back some of the services. There was a great Oregonian article a few years back about a grandfather who brought his grandchild to the library only to find it was closed after he had voted to keep it open to pay higher taxes. It's hard for us to make promises and not be able to go on those promises based upon these limitations. there are other voters, as you know, that vote for something and they cannot, they don't even have to pay it because their properties are compressed. So they're, in essence, voting to have somebody else pay for something that they all want. At that point, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and after that, I'll be more than happy to answer Representative Winsett's question on PERS, if you'd like, Chair.
Yep, that would be a great place to start the questions.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Councilor Winsett, you asked about PERS and how it's impacted on that chart. Part of our, part of those expenses in all those areas, not only public safety, is our contribution to PERS. It's a percentage of salary. And that covers our current retirees as well as our planned retirees. There's an actuarial valuation. It's a very complicated formula. For example, our public safety, we pay about 20% in Tualatin of the public safety salary of all the officers towards PERS. That's factored into that 55%. Once someone retires, that is paid for through PERS outside of that. So we, those numbers don't include what we're paying for retirees, but it's how much we have to pay into the system for our past retirees as well as our future.
About 20% then, you would say, of the 50, rounded 50%, at least for your city.
Let me correct, Chair Barnhart, Whitsett, 20% of the salaries of the officers that are on the street there is right in that 55%. So it's not 20% of that 55. It's, we pay about 20%. And there's a lot of cities that pay much higher.
Okay.
Just for example, 12, so we pay about 20% of a salary into our annual expenses. And that total annual expenses is that 55% of the number. I couldn't tell you how much is of that 55%.
Your total public safety budget is certainly way more than half for wages and benefits, isn't it?
Yes. We are in our... In our general fund, it's about 71% of our salaries, or our general fund budget is salaries and benefits.
So it would be 20% of 71. 71% of the 55%, and then 20% of that. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, we could do the arithmetic later, but yeah, I think you have the point. Was that, Representative Benz, please?
You, Sharon, I was anxiously waiting for you both to address the question I posed to the previous panel. And you both didn't. And
how you got to get try again?
Exactly. I'm going to ask you again. So you both did mention why you felt we needed to make these changes, and the reason you gave was that there's an ever increasing cost for the services you are providing, and one of those you mentioned was because of the requirement that you pay a certain amount under mandatory. I forgot how you put it. What was it? Media, I can remember.
Binding arbitration.
And so I'm not here today to defend the property tax system. It's a wonky mess, and that's being really kind. The trouble with it is that's only one half of it. The other half is your needs. You need to address those because people fear that you can't control them. And I'm here to tell you, you can't. You just said so, binding arbitration. And so when people hear that, they go, wait a minute. If they can't control how much they're spending, why should we give them more?
Right.
And that's the question I need to have you guys address. Because when you go out to the vote, which, by the way, is a constitutional amendment, which I think is quite a bit higher than that local option levy. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Is there a difference?
No.
They're both the same. How much? What's the local option levy have to pass by? What's the vote?
Double majority.
50% plus one.
50% plus one. What's a constitutional amendment got to pass?
50% plus one.
I thought it was higher. So if it's only 50%.
In Florida, it's higher, not in
Oregon. Oh, I say Florida. Confusing. Maybe in Eastern Oregon it's higher. My point here is I think there's an awful lot of those people on fixed income that fear what was going to happen because you can't control your spending. And they're going to be very unhappy about the possibility of us changing this thing unless we can convince them that you can control your spending. So that's why I say what happened last week was a huge blow to any of these kinds of things passing. Unless you guys can come in and say, oh, on the spending side, and I didn't hear it. So I'd love to hear it now.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. And to some extent, we are mandated to perform certain functions as a local municipal government. We are bound by binding arbitration to whoever kind of gets in that line first sets a wage, and we can either agree to that or have an arbitrator tell our voters that this is what you have to pay this employee group from an overall structural city and how we control what we're doing. We are to the point now that we are cutting into the bone, and so we are not providing the services that our citizens actually would require based on the revenue that's available to us. We don't service our parks for over half of the year. We're with the two fire stations that closed, our response times are increasing in many cases for life-threatening emergencies. How does a city control its costs when so many of those mechanisms of control are not in our control? They reside at a higher level of government. And I think that's what we have to work to address, because our hands are tied in a lot of things.
Representative Davis?
And thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for your testimony. It strikes me in reviewing this entire matter that there are two broad competing interests here, and maybe not, they're not competing. One is the intent under 5 and 50 to create essentially a spending limitation mm-hmm. on the size of government. And voters and I think the legislature in referring Measure 50 had a legitimate interest in doing that. And that's part of the balance. The other balance is the services desired. And I believe that local option levies and local bonds that we see for specific services, education, facilities, strike at that chord, which is voters saying, I would like to see a school facility, or I would like to see an aquatic center, or I would like to see public safety services. But that tension, the fact that voters may support that, I don't think is an indication that they support the idea of let's just let the whole beast grow as much as it wants.
Right.
And that's the tension. The City Clubs of Portland's 2013 report is really interesting. It's 150 pages. It summarizes the state of the system very well. One, Oregon's property tax system is inequitable. Two, Oregon's property tax system undermines local control. Three, the system fails to sustain service levels approved by the voters. Exemptions exacerbate inequities. It's difficult to understand, and it requires, finally, bold, comprehensive reform. And I'm really disappointed, actually, that the League came back 2 years after having these exact same proposals with the exact same proposals after not receiving legislative support in 2013. Because I think what the City Club found and what the League has found is we probably have one bite at the apple here. Probably have one big ask of Oregon voters to get this right in a way that funds schools, that funds essential services, that funds the things that voters would like to see without letting the beast grow beyond where voters think it should be. That's a really tough balance to reach. I'm encouraged that you are supportive of a work group function or a larger discussion, but attacking it piecemeal I think creates a lot of issues, especially if we only attack it piecemeal with the idea that, well, we'll just tell the voters that this will make it more fair. I doubt voters will go for that. They want to see some bang for the buck in the reforms that they pass is what I would imagine. So we have 50 other states that do it different ways, some probably better, some probably worse. We have City Club's 150-page report. We've got LRO with innumerable reports every year they've done on the subject. So there's a lot of data out there, a lot of research. But balancing those two competing interests is really the challenge. And unfortunately, I don't think these measures do it, but I'm very encouraged that you're interested in talking about ways to do it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I'd like to hear now from Roger Beyer and Sean Gilliams.
Chair Barnhart, I just wanted to add a little bit more for the record of the extra testimony that's been submitted, if I could. I can do it really quickly.
Do you have it in writing?
It's submitted on the record. I just was going to list the cities that have already submitted testimony and then just add number 7 and number 8 we didn't get to mention.
Do it in 45 seconds. That would be great, because I really need to get to the other witnesses.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Representative Dave, to answer Representative Davis's question, I think originally we came to you with all constitutional issues, fixing the structure from 5 and 50. We've added number 7 and number 8 to look at exemptions, deferrals, and intangible properties and things. Most of the big problems with the structure are in the Constitution, and we can't do those accept as a referral because there's too many subjects. And so that's why we're asking for a work group to do it all in one swoop. But to have enough levers to adjust the rates and things, we need other pieces so that we could keep it neutral, perhaps provide a different cap that does provide assurance to voters that it's not going to go up significantly. We need more pieces. And so we've added in exemptions. There's the charitable exemption that's a mess right now. We have all kinds of exemptions that are old. Some of them are local options. Some of them are not. So a work group is the only way that we can really look at business, look at industrial property, commercial property, residential issues, and structure all at once and do something that the voters would be willing to support that will assure some stability. And the list of cities quickly is just that I've already submitted are Corvallis, Happy Valley, Lakeside, Turner, Umatilla, Wood Village, and Tualatin.
Thank you. And all of those are in Ellis.
Correct.
Thank you very much. And now we'll hear from Roger Beyer and Sean Gillians, please. And on deck, and I hope we get to them, David Klein, Jenna Ingram, Elizabeth Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Oregon Seed Council, and the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I've submitted a letter. You're receiving it now. It has four other organizations listed that all are opposed to these two measures. You've heard only from the cities, and I guess I would tell you to start that with the exception possibly the Oregon Association of Nurseries, all of these associations I'm representing today aren't in cities. So let's get that on the record first. There are probably some nurseries who are in the cities, but the rest of these groups all pretty much operate outside of the city. But that doesn't mean our members aren't heavily invested in the property tax system in the state, because it is just as it means just as much to the county residents. So I'm not going to go into great detail here. We are opposed to these measures. You've got the letter there. I'd just like to point out a couple things that some of the things that you've heard, I think, are interesting in that if you reset, as the number 12, HJR 12 would say, if you reset on sale, you create inequities in the property tax system, same as you're trying to fix. The inequities just go to the other side. The inequities go to the person who bought the property instead of the person who continues to own the property. And when people are buying property, they many times factor that into the property when they buy it and what they can afford to pay for the property. So by resetting on sale, and I can recall when Measure 50 was passed, that was one of the when Measure 50 was debated in the legislature and passed, I was seated at the dais on that side of the dais at the time, and that was one of the great discussions at the time, was whether or not there should be a reset on sale. And it was determined by the California model at that time, which does that creates huge inequities in property values, and you have two houses identical sitting next to each other and can be paying vast differences of property taxes because of the reset on sale. The other thing that does for our members and people on this letter is the issue of a transfer, especially through inheritance and or transfer from one generation to the next. Does that trigger a reset? If it does, you then put that next generation of person trying to farm or work the land mm-hmm. at a huge disadvantage because of the property taxes he or she would be forced to pay. That is a huge concern we have on Measure 12. If you look at the conclusion letter that you just saw presented by the cities, I find it interesting. I guess it depends on whose eyes you're looking through, because they say they want a system that is stable, stability, and predictability. Well, if you look at from the property owner's perspective, the current system we have is pretty stable and pretty predictable. Maybe not to the cities, but it is to the property owners. If you look at fairness and equity, It relatively fairness and equity. We might fail on that one because of the compression issue you heard about. But as a property owner, you pretty much know what you're going to pay every year. It doesn't go up or down very much. Simplicity and clarity. I don't think any property tax system is ever going to be simple or clear. Let's just set that one aside. That doesn't happen. Adequacy and sustainability, again, maybe not for the cities, but for the landowners who have the ability to approve local option taxes. And you heard from the testimony that whereas the compression really affects local options, they factor that in when they put them on the ballot. So there may be hundreds of millions of dollars in compression now being lost, but these local governments factored that into their ballot measures before they asked for them. So What would the real number be if there wasn't compression? I didn't hear that number. And finally, voter and local control, we have that through the local option system. So we're not saying the system is perfect. We're not necessarily opposed to a big look, but these measures on their face don't, we cannot support and hopefully don't move forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We obviously have significant concerns with HJR 12 as well, which I think we've had before this body several sessions in a row, and we've sort of expressed them. I think Representative Davis and Mr. Beyer did a pretty good job actually laying out most of my arguments, so I appreciate that. Thank you. The one thing I would say, and I've brought this up in previous testimony, in the 2012 election, we obviously did extensive survey research around property taxes and other tax issues with home ownership. And overwhelmingly, we found that Oregonians found that their property taxes were either too high or just about right. I looked while I was sitting in the back of the room at our last survey, 46%, and these were statewide surveys, 46% thought they were too high, 42% about right, 5% too low. You got a huge hurdle to clear on property tax reform when you have people sort of thinking in that regard. And I agree with previous testimony that you're going to have to look at something that's comprehensive that solves all the sort of perceived inequities that are in our system. You're never going to solve all of them. Any artificial cap on growth of property taxes is going to have some inequity in it. And Roger mentioned Prop 13 in California, which is sort of what we were modeling it after. It has a 1% cap, by the way, in exchange for having the reset at point of sale. It has a 1% cap for people who stay in there. And you very much see what he talked about, where people decide to stay in their homes longer and longer and longer because they know that they're going to, in their next house, pay significantly more in property taxes. As we have an aging population coming where we're encouraging folks to sell their big old house and downsize, we actually run contrary to that sort of desire when we're saying we're putting in some sort of incentive to stay rather than move to a new home with a reset. We also have concerns on the potential chilling effect it could have on the real estate industry. Our most recent data, which I think is also from 2012, the real estate industry is a $29 billion industry in Oregon. It accounts for 15% of the gross domestic product. When you're putting disincentives to sell your property or to move up to a new home, that can have an impact there. For many sessions, I came up and said, you got to address the cost drivers before you can get property tax reform. And then when we brought this in the short session, I said, congratulations, you finally addressed the drivers with the PERS thing. And now I'm back here with my 2012 testimony after the Supreme Court decision saying you got to address the cost drivers before you can get it. I think you guys did yeoman's work to try and address those. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't agree with us on that one. Lastly, I'd say Oregon Association of Realtors is happy to participate in any sort of work group going forward. I think it's imperative that they are involved. I happily volunteer Mr. Cleave, who's at the back of the room. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
He just woke up.
If there's one or two very short ones, I have another panel and a half to go. Representative Reed.
Very short. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to dispute your testimony, I was struck by your quotation of the poll, and I just wonder, have you ever encountered any different results when you ask people how they feel about any sort of taxes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, we focus solely on taxes around home ownership, so I couldn't tell you on the other ones. But, I mean, it's obvious that inevitably people feel they pay too much in taxes regardless.
We were enormously startled the other day when we heard a bunch of pilots come in and tell us, please raise our taxes on aviation fuel, for precisely the reason that Representative Reed is alluding to. Yeah. Very few people will come and say, please raise my taxes.
Well, and Mr. Chair, in all seriousness, I think when you see a specific benefit and you can say as an industry, please raise our fees or things like that because we see a specific benefit. I think when you're talking about property taxes in general where it's just going into a general fund, that's it's a much more difficult argument to make.
Thing. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add, seeing Mr. Jillians offered Sean Cleave for a work group, I drew the short straw from these seven groups today, so some other person would draw that short straw.
Thank you. David Klein, Jenna Ingram, Elizabeth Edwards, please. And I'll let you know that members have 3 o'clock committee meetings, so be as brief as you can and still be complete.
Understood. In the order that you brought us up?
Whatever you prefer.
I was almost going to take a pass on testimony based on your comments, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, I'm David Klein. I'm the city manager for the City of Independence. I'm a former member of the League of Oregon Cities Board, and I've served in several communities in Oregon. The ask again is about forming the work group and giving people a chance to vote. I understood the testimony from the Realty Board that people do not like taxes. We understand that. During my career in Oregon, I've taken two measures to the public for property tax measures, and in both instances, they certainly started out with high negatives. In the end, they both passed because people learned to understand what the need was. One was for sewer, one was for general operations. So I think you just have to give people a chance to understand the issues and give the opportunity to speak to them.
Thank you.
Genoa Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association and Clackamas Fire District 1. I will be extremely brief. The Fire District Directors Association and Clackamas are neutral on both of these bills. We are here to discuss a more holistic approach to looking at the property tax structure in Oregon. Obviously, there are lots of ways to come at this, the school districts, public safety, et cetera. My piece of it is public safety, and I'm not going to miss this chance to take the opportunity to say, gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a segment of people out there who are willing to step up and perform some of these vital services free of charge? Oh, look, there are. They're called volunteer firefighters. There are two bills in this committee that would provide incentives. That's all I'm going to say about that. Just to say, though, sorry, Mr. Chair.
No, you're fine. Thank you.
Just to say, though, we have heard rumblings about a work group, and if that is the case, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, who are elected public officials just like yourselves, who set the budgets and oversee these operations in public safety, would very much like to be at the table. And with that, I will cut the rest of my remarks off.
Thank you. City of Portland.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Edwards. I will also make my marks very short. I was asked by the League to just provide a quick snippet on what is happening in the City of Portland with regard to our property tax. And the truth is that we're experiencing growing inequality in tax treatment across different geographic areas of the city. The market value of properties in 1995-96 are very different from what they look like today. And those parts of the city that have experienced rapid growth now are taxed on a much lower portion of the real market value than those parts of the city that haven't experienced that growth, which means out in parts of outer East Portland, you have neighbors that are routinely taxed on 75% or more of the real market value, while folks in the inner part of the city might be at 45% or less. This is a major equity concern, and it's a major concern for our city council. So if and when a work group comes together, we would welcome the opportunity to be a part of it.
And there's a correlation, isn't there, between income and those numbers that you've given us. The lower-income people tend to be taxed at a higher percentage of their real market value.
Chair Barnhart, yes, that's absolutely true.
Questions for this panel? Thank you so much, and we appreciate those facts. Marcia Kelly is our last signed-up witness. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today in addition to Marcia? Good afternoon,
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Marcia Kelly. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And what is the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition talking about? Property taxes. Well, I signed up only on SDR 12, which is an equity issue. It's a growing equity issue. The compression that makes and in addition, the compression that disallows you to tax people equally for the same provision of services is an equity issue, too. I serve on the Transit District Board in Salem, where the urban growth boundary, it's an elected position. I've been on the board. I got on the board the year before ballot measure 5 passed. So I have been through all of the ups and the downs. And the downs are because of compression and rising costs. And if you think about fuel as rising cost in providing transportation services, it's a big one. because of rising costs, we told the voters in 2008 that we would cut weekend service, the Saturday service, and have to reduce evening hours if we could not get a levy passed. We lost by 4 percentage points. It was just right at the beginning of the downturn. So this year we're contemplating going out to provide that, restore that service and add a little bit more. In order to provide the $5 million that it will cost to add that service, we will have to ask voters for 58 cents per thousand to provide that service, and that would be added on to the rest of the day's service at 76 cents, and it's because of compression. We wouldn't have to ask for that much if we didn't have compression. So at a minimum, there has to be something done about the inequity of what properties are assessed at so that we can get, so that we can deal with what is really an equitable situation for the provision of services.
Thank you. Questions for Marcia? We appreciate your testimony. We appreciate all the testimony that we've heard today. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for taking a vacation day. We appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearings on House Joint Resolution 20 and House Joint Resolution 12. A committee, see you tomorrow for our long day at 1 o'clock. Thanks. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. And remember, we're meeting with the Senate at 8:30 tomorrow morning as part of the Joint Tax Credit Committee. You did a very good job last week. Let's beat them again and be here on time. With that, the committee is adjourned. He's adjourned.